Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Mind Shift Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, coming to you from The Rock here in North Wales, where we've just survived the most brutal storm, not of the century, but certainly of the last several years. They called it the Beast from the East. It was a Siberian blast that had us blanketed with up to 5 feet of snow. We were stuck in here for a week. But over the weekend, my neighbor and I worked for hours and hours shoveling, and finally, on Monday, we were free. We got out after being stuck here for a week. One of the unexpected benefits, though, of being stuck here for a week was that I was able to make some great connections for upcoming podcasts, and I did a few recordings. In fact, one's coming up after these two episodes with David Fitzgerald that I'm going to be bringing you today and next week. So look out for that. Coming up in a few weeks will be my discussion with a friend of mine. His name's Tim Malins, and we go way, way, way back. When I was a kid back in school, about fourth, fifth grade, he came up from Southern California and suddenly dropped into our little fundamentalist Christian school, even though he had no background in the church or religion or anything. And he's going to tell his story about how the teachings of fundamentalist Christianity affected him as we went on from that school and on into Christian high school. And what's fascinating about Tim's story is how he offers up some really interesting insights as to what it's like to be dropped into that sort of a context from the outside. And ultimately, he's going to describe how he became an atheist. So look out for that coming up in about 3 weeks. So getting back to today's episode, I am really excited to be bringing you part one of a fantastic and challenging conversation with atheist and author David Fitzgerald. He's the author of some books on the question of whether or not Jesus of Nazareth actually historically existed at all. And we're going to be getting into that in just a few minutes. But before I get into the conversation with David, I just wanted to say a couple of things. First of all, a huge thank you to Keyes DeWitt. He is the latest member of our Mindshift podcast group. He's become a Patreon supporter of this show. So we want to welcome Keyes to the conversation. I just want to say, too, that if you're interested in supporting the work of Mindshift, you can go to patreon.com/mindshiftpodcast. You can find out some more information about why I started the show. And basically, your support helps to keep this thing going. It helps me cover costs like podcast hosting, website hosting, basically everything that goes into maintaining a weekly podcast. So that would be a great help if you are interested in supporting this show. I'll just mention this too, that one of the rewards for becoming a supporter of this show and being added into our private Facebook group is that I tend to post a lot of documents in there that I'm in the process of writing. For example, our post-evangelical writers group that I started last year, we're working on a collaborative book project, and we've tentatively titled it something like Out of the Wilderness, Life Beyond Evangelicalism, and we're working on individual chapters, and I've been posting up the work that I've been doing on our private Facebook group. I've got a couple of chapters that I've written already. I've done an introduction chapter for it. I just did that the other day, and I posted that on the group. So if you want to have early access to some of the chapters that I'm writing for this book, then you can become a supporter of the show for as little as $1 a month. Also, I'll just mention too that if you want to support the show in another way, you can buy a Mindshift Podcast t-shirt on TeePublic, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes also. Now, before we get into this chat with David, I wanted to take a few minutes and just reflect on some of the implications of the subject that we're going to be covering, this issue of the historicity of Jesus. From my point of view, coming out of evangelical Christianity, this whole question as to whether or not Jesus of Nazareth actually lived or actually existed, it's absolutely massive. But this is something that deserves some really serious close attention and some scrutiny. If the Christian religion is indeed true and the biblical record is accurate historically, then Christians should not be afraid of such challenges to their belief system. So, for example, we should be free to ask such questions as the following. Was there such a person as Jesus of Nazareth? Was the person that they talk about in the Gospels, did he really exist? Is he nothing more than a literary and theological construct made up by later authors and editors? And if so, what are the implications of all of these questions if in fact he did not exist? And I wanted to read something for you. This is from David's book, which is titled Nailed: 10 Christian Myths That Show Jesus Never Existed at All. And what he does is he basically tackles head on some of these popular myths. And the first one he talks about is the idea that Jesus was a myth. That's got to be a ridiculous thing, surely, isn't it? Everyone knows that Jesus existed, didn't he? Well, he challenges that myth head on. And what he argues in his book is this. He says, quote, "Most people certainly believe that there had to have been a central figure that began Christianity. Perhaps he was just a wandering teacher or an exorcist, an apocalyptic prophet or a zealot who opposed the Romans. Perhaps he was all these things or even a composite of several such early first figures. But at any rate, surely there had to be somebody at the original core of Christianity, arguably the most famous individual in human history. All this seems to be a perfectly reasonable, completely natural assumption to make. So why would anyone be so foolish as to propose that Jesus never existed?" And he goes on to say, "Doesn't it make more sense to assume that there was a historical Jesus, even if we are unable to recover the real facts about his life and death? As it turns out, no. The opposite is true." He says, "The closer we look at the evidence for Jesus, the less solid evidence one finds, and the more one finds suspicious silences and curious resemblances to the pagan and Jewish religious ideas and philosophies that preceded Christianity. And once one begins to parse out the origins of this tradition or that teaching from their various sources, the sweater begins unraveling quickly until it becomes very difficult to buy that there even was, or even could have been, any historical figure at the center." End quote. Obviously, this is a huge, massive issue, isn't it? It's got to be. And in this episode and the next, coming out next Friday, David and I are going to get into the historical record and really tear apart this issue of the historicity of Jesus, the reliability of the Gospels, the supposed eyewitnesses that have been brought out by biblical scholars over the years that they claim proves that Jesus existed. But of course, if you start questioning these things, then you have to wonder where it's going to take you, especially if you're a Christian who believes firmly that not only did Jesus exist, but that the depiction of him in the Gospels is in fact accurate, that all the things that we know about him that come from those Gospels are completely true, and everything else in the New Testament that follows on from that, like the writings of Paul and the other epistles, they're all built on what Jesus did in terms of his actions in the Gospels, his death on the cross, his resurrection, and everything else. And that's really the core message, the core gospel message of Christianity itself. So if you question those things, or if you can show that it's not really true, or at least maybe not as reliable as we've been led to believe, then the whole house of cards comes crashing down. So the implications of this discussion are absolutely massive, aren't they? Reminds me of a story. When I was back in Bible college back in the mid-90s, every year they'd bring in some special author or speaker for a week-long speaking conference. And this one year they brought in author Paul Meyer, and he was the guy who had written some really interesting books called Pontius Pilate, The Flames of Rome. And as it turned out, I was actually in the church history class at the time, and we were reading one of his books, which is called A Skeleton in God's Closet. And it's a really interesting book because the premise of it is these archaeologists in Israel doing a dig, they uncover what appears to be the grave of Jesus of Nazareth, who actually didn't resurrect from the dead, but actually was hidden away by some of his followers. But he was proclaimed, of course, as being risen from the dead. And as I read that book, what really struck me was how important this doctrine of the resurrection is to Christianity. If, for example, the bones of Jesus were to be found in some unmarked grave somewhere around Jerusalem, how would that affect Christianity? Well, according to Meyer's book, it starts to destroy the very fabric of Christianity itself all around the world. And what really struck me at the time in listening to his lectures every day at the Bible college in this chapel service was how he presented seemingly incontrovertible evidence outside of the Bible, not only to prove that Jesus existed, but that everything that was talked about him in the Gospels was in fact historically accurate and true. And I can remember him talking about how authors like Luke were historians of the first rank. He was one of the best historians that we know of out of the ancient world. And I came away thinking to myself, you know, Christianity is a really good religion in the sense that there's all this extra biblical, archaeological, and documentary evidence that proves that the Gospels and the rest of the New Testament, and of course, by extension, the Bible too, is all factually, historically true. And therefore, we can trust it in terms of what it claims theologically. And really, this is the whole ball of wax, isn't it? Or as David says, the whole sweater starts to unravel if you start to pick at it from really any one direction. I'm interested also to hear your thoughts and feedback on this show. I'll talk about that a little bit more after the conversation with David, how you can get a hold of me on social media. But I will say that I want to hear your thoughts. I want to hear your feedback because this is going to be a very challenging and thought-provoking discussion. So let's get on into it. Was Jesus really a historical figure, a man who existed in the first century? Was he the same person that we read about in the Gospels? Or was he nothing more than a myth? I'm joined today by author and atheist David Fitzgerald, all the way from San Francisco, California. I'm really looking forward to having this chat with you today, David. I'm so thankful that you've joined me as we get into the subject of the historicity of Jesus, whether or not Jesus even existed at all. How reliable are the gospel records in bringing us this Jesus? And of course, what the implications are for Christianity. You are, of course, the author of several really interesting books. One of the most challenging ones that you wrote was Nailed: 10 Christian Myths That Show Jesus Never Existed at All, as well as some newer publications. Why don't you tell us about your most recent publication, David?
Well, on the nonfiction front, I've got a book called Jesus Mything in Action. It's actually a three-part book that's the follow-up book to Nailed. And on the fiction side, my wife and I just co-wrote a science fiction book, the first in a sci-fi trilogy.
But would you say your specialty is this question of the historicity of Jesus? Is that you told me the other day you've been studying and researching this for 20 years.
Yeah, just about 20 years now. And I wouldn't say it's my, it's sort of become by accident my expertise, because it's something that I just got interested around year 2000 or so, and it's just blown up ever since. I haven't really been able to shake it. So I'm sort of a reluctant Jesus scholar.
Now, what got you into this topic in the first place? Did you come at it as a historian or a theologian? What's the kind of backstory there? Were you a Christian before and then became an atheist?
Gotcha. Yeah, I was definitely a raised Christian and was Christian all the way up until college. But I had probably been an atheist for about 16 years before this happened. And what happened was I didn't start out as a mythicist at all. It was just the opposite. I was interested in trying to figure out how much of the Gospels shows the real Jesus and how much of it is just legendary bullshit that got piled on top later. And when you try to parse that out, it gets really interesting really fast. The first thing that kind of blew my mind, the first red flag that went up, is just how bad our evidence is for Jesus and how little there is of it. It not only that it just is mostly relies on the Gospels, but the Gospels themselves all rely on a single Gospel. And Christianity before the Gospels are written is very different from Christianity after the Gospels are written. So all these strange red flags were popping up just out of my curiosity to try to pin down what was the real Jesus. And long story short, 2 years later, I'm thinking, you know, I don't think this guy existed at all. And I was so shocked to realize that I wasn't the first or the only person saying that and making that argument.
And we know that this quest for the historical Jesus, as it were, it's popularized by people like Albert Schweitzer, in the 19th century? So it's not a new question. And there were people asking the questions about the historicity of Jesus even back as far as, the 18th century even?
Yeah, that's probably where the most modern attempts started. And the funny thing about that is most Christian scholars act like that was all debunked, you know, in the Victorian era, when nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, you talked about the quest for the historical Jesus. They've actually had those who accept that paradigm say that they've had three historical quests for Jesus, and at the end of each one, they've thrown up their hands and said, oh, no, this isn't working. Let's go back to square one and start all over again. And so after three quests and over 100 years of this scholarship, trying to find what the consensus is on who Jesus was is just, it's non-existent. You get 50 Jesus scholars in the same room, they'll be talking about 50 different Jesuses.
We know that there is a tendency, as Hector Avalos said, all God talk is self-referential, for sure, isn't it? And I see this more and more. Once I've kind of come around to that way of thinking, I see it all over the place. I see statements about Jesus particularly, but God as well, and people sort of craft him in their own image, and they make him into this person that they kind of want him to be. Either he's a hippie, peace-loving guru who loves everybody and accepts everyone, or he's this militant pro-NRA, pro-Republican, pro-Trump, pro-whatever type of Jesus, or in any shade of that spectrum in between. So it's true. Jesus has been co-opted, hasn't he?
Yeah, he sure has. And Schweitzer was saying that over 100 years ago, that when you look at Jesus, it looks like a mirror of the guy who's doing the searching for him. Clint, there's a great bumper sticker. It's I said it, God believes it, that settles it.
Yes, I've seen that many times in the States, for sure. It's funny because here in the UK, people don't tend to go in for bumper stickers like they do in America. So you don't even see the Christian fish that you see all over the place in the States. You see the Christian fish all over the place. And now, of course, there's the Darwin fish and everything else, isn't there? One of the subjects that I've studied, and I find it really interesting, is this whole debate between the liberals and the fundamentalists that comes out of the late 19th century and on into the 20th century. And as we're saying, we find liberal scholars like Albert Schweitzer, who wrote his book in 1906, wasn't it, The Quest of the Historical Jesus? And when you examine that time period, scholars like Schweitzer and others were really trying to come to grips with some of the findings of historical biblical scholarship that was coming out of the end of the 19th century and on into the 20th century. Seems like what they were saying was this: if the Bible, the biblical record, is not necessarily accurate historically, archaeologically, scientifically, is there anything left to this thing we call our Christian faith? And it seems like they kind of came up with this idea that, well, what we need to do is get back to the real Jesus, as it were, not necessarily the Jesus that we read about in the Gospels, but the Jesus of faith, or the Jesus of the historical Jesus, the person who may have been a guru or a wise teacher, but probably didn't do the miracles and things that we read about. But what were you left with? The fundamentalists, of course, responded so militantly, didn't they, against the liberal gospel, that you had this huge culture war, which I think is still being played out in many ways, even in America today, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And Australia, too, and anywhere in the Christian world.
Yeah, Australia is quite a conservative place in many ways, isn't it, in terms of religion?
Though they did get rid of Ken Ham and foisted him on us, so yes, at least that much of conservatism has come to America.
Yes, he's built himself a life-size replica of Noah's Ark that you can go visit in, I think it's in Louisville, Kentucky, somewhere around there. So, yeah.
But unfortunately, no one seems to be going to visit it, except atheists, ironically.
That's true. It's turned out to be a bust.
Completely going under.
Yeah, it's true. Not doing so well, is he? Getting back to the subject of this quest for the historical Jesus and the historicity of Jesus, I was thinking about this today, and I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about this. It seems like there's at least three options that come out of this question, is whether or not Jesus actually existed. One of them is, of course, you could say, well, that Jesus did exist, and the Gospels and the stuff that we read about in the Gospels are true, and that's basically classic Christianity, isn't it? That he ministered, he did miracles, he died on the cross, he rose from the dead, and that's classic Christianity. The other option is that Jesus existed, but what we read about him in the Gospels is not necessarily true, and that opens up a whole bunch of questions about the reliability of the Gospels. And then there's the third option, that he just didn't exist at all, in which case, who's the person that we actually are? Who is the Jesus that we read about in the Gospels? What are the implications for certainly Christianity if Jesus actually never existed at all? Do those three options kind of resonate with what you've studied at all?
Oh, yeah. And that second option, that there was a Jesus, that he's not reflected very well in the Gospels, that's a huge big tent, and there's all kind of room to, you know, that's a big can of worms that you open up when you say that. And there's nothing, I want to make that really clear, too. I'm not a mythicist, because I think that the only thing that is possible is that he was a myth. What I am saying is that even though there's nothing implausible, there's nothing improbable about there having been a real Jesus, when we look at our evidence doesn't point to that. It doesn't even point to a mere mundane, mere mortal guy who existed and got, you know, exalted to a god, or even a compilation of different guys who all became coalesced into one figure. It points to a literary figure. It points to an allegorical figure. And it points to the early Christians not being organized at all, not starting in Jerusalem, and snowballing down Golgotha, but all over, spread all over the Roman Empire in all these different corners, and not being able to agree about the first thing about what their savior god was, in a time when all these other religions in the Hellenistic world are also creating these savior gods from rebooted pagan gods. Everything we see in early Christianity looks and feels exactly like a Jewish attempt to create one of these savior god cults.
Because it seems like in reading your work, the problem with the first two options, that he existed and everything that is written about him in the Gospels is true, or he existed but it's not necessarily true, which is the classic sort of liberal gospel, isn't it? The problem with both of those positions, as I read your research, is that the historic evidence doesn't support the first two options. You don't find evidence for him, because what I was reading and doing research in preparation for talking to you, when you take a closer look at this issue of the historicity of Jesus, what you discover is this. There's no archaeological or physical evidence to support that a person called Jesus that we read about in the Gospels existed. The only evidence we have is documentary evidence, and then the only real evidence is the Gospels themselves, isn't it? When you look at extra-biblical literature, what have you found that led you to the third conclusion, that he didn't exist at all?
Well, it's funny. No matter which approach you take, whether it's just the Gospels, whether it's Jesus inside the New Testament, the rest of the epistles, or whether it's Jesus outside the Bible altogether, they all point to the same thing, that these are all uncoordinated Jesus movements that don't have anything in common with each other, fight with each other, can't agree about the first things about Jesus, and all seem to be talking about a spiritual figure. And they talk about themselves, being apostles, not because they're friends and family of Jesus, but because there's this other list of qualifications to become an apostle. It's funny when you hear what Paul says is an apostle, hanging out with Jesus doesn't even make the cut. Being related to Jesus doesn't make the cut. He acts like all the people that we think of as Jesus' disciples and Jesus' friends and family, he acts like they don't have any better claim to being connected to Jesus than he does. In fact, he says they're not even real Christians, which blows my mind, if these are supposed to be Jesus' friends and family. He never even uses the word disciples in any context, ever, full stop, in his writing.
That's one school of thought, isn't it? That basically Paul kind of, I won't say he invented Christianity, but in a way he took it perhaps further than if there was a Jesus who existed, than he may have intended in the first place. I think that was one of the scenes from the movie The Last Temptation of Christ. That's a real striking scene, if you recall, where Jesus is walking with his family, his wife and children, and he hears Paul preaching. And he says, wait a minute, none of this is true. Everything you're saying is not true. I didn't die on the cross. I am the guy you're talking about. And Paul says, look, none of that matters. It's just the people believe what I'm saying. And of course, that was a very controversial film, wasn't it?
And you know what's ironic about that? It's in many ways, that movie was totally reverent and Christian in character, but the thought of Jesus having sex just inflamed Christians. Of him, of the torture porn version that Mel Gibson did, Christians love that, but the thought of Jesus having sex is just, you know,
having a family. It's unbelievable that film caused such a firestorm all over evangelicalism, and yet there's a disclaimer right at the beginning in the film that it's basically one man's vision. It just says, this is one version of the Jesus that I'm trying to portray. But Christians acted like it was debunking all of Christianity, that's the aim of the film, but it wasn't.
It was true, yeah. Well, that's the thing. They didn't even watch the movie. If they'd watched the movie, they would have appreciated it, I think, in a way that atheists didn't appreciate it. Because it's a very reverent movie. All in all, it's like, well, what if he was half God, half man, and was tempted like a man?
In the film, he really wrestles with his calling, I guess, to be the Messiah, doesn't he? And that's a very human kind of thing, I guess, as the film portrayed it.
Before we jump off that, I want to point out that even in the earliest part of Christianity, they were already having these kind of debates right from the Gospels. When you have our four Gospels and you compare them with each other, Mark's Gospel, the Jesus in that, is so much more human, so fallible, so human, and yet he's also an allegorical figure. Everything that happens in Mark and Luke's gospel, still keeping up with the allegories, but they improve on Jesus with every single attempt to make a new gospel. None of these guys set out to write the four gospels, you know, or the gospel according to Matthew, the gospel according to Luke. They were all setting out to write the improving on the only gospel they had. John, when he came along later, he doesn't even try to keep up with those guys. He has his own take on who Jesus is and Jesus was, and he doesn't even try to match most of the gospel.
The whole synoptic problem, that's what you're referring to, isn't it? That Matthew,
absolutely,
Mark, and Luke are very similar in many ways, but when you actually compare them side by side by side, there's some pretty stark differences between the three. You have a real hard time explaining, and of course scholars have spilled a lot of ink going over this,
yeah,
issue, haven't they? I mean, I used to teach the Gospels in theological schools over here, and we used to go through this problem with the students, and I would make them look at parallel passages and try to account for the differences between the three. And of course,
yeah,
they would come up with fanciful explanations to why are there such,
exactly,
massive differences. In fact, that reminds me of something funny that Hector Avalos said when he was on this podcast last year. He said, actually, it was reading the Bible that turned me into an atheist. And in a way, that's kind,
yeah,
of, you can either try to account for all these differences, or you can just step back, as you said, and go, and wait a minute, maybe they don't reconcile. Maybe we can't harmonize these gospels, yeah, into sort of one homogenous whole. Maybe that's not the way we,
yeah,
should be looking at this thing.
Exactly. When you look at them with Occam's razor, it becomes really obvious that there's something wrong. And in fact, that's not even controversial in biblical scholarly circles. That's been the majority opinion for over a century, that Mark was written first and Matthew and Luke based their gospels primarily on his gospel. Some historicists accuse Jesus mythicists of just being way out in the weeds somewhere, out in the fields, doing their own crazy research. Well, most of what the serious mythicists that I work with are arguing are consensus. They are the majority opinions. The only difference between us and the historicists is we take our conclusions just a little further than they're comfortable with.
Now, what's interesting to me is going back on this question of documentary evidence, if you take the Gospels out of the equation, what are you actually left with in terms of extra-biblical evidence, I guess in air quotes, of the historical person Jesus? Because in reading some of your research, it seems like everybody wants to point to Josephus as the earliest contemporary, not eyewitness, but he was the one who wrote some things about Jesus, allegedly, and he was 100
right,
years after the fact, wasn't he?
He was not even born when Jesus was meant to have been alive, and he was writing at the very end of the first century, so he was writing at least generations removed. But the funny thing about Josephus, not only is that passage that he's often quoted for a forgery, I mean, there's no question it's a forgery, but Christians keep trying to move the goalpost and say, well, it's not a total forgery. And
partial,
I spend a lot of ink pointing out why that doesn't work and why, no, it's clearly all a forgery for many, many, many reasons. But even somebody who's a historicist, a devout historicist like Bart Ehrman says, you know what, this isn't true, but even if every single word in this passage were true, all this is saying is what Christians were saying the man, your average man on the street would have told somebody in the year 90. It doesn't add anything to the question. And as you point out, this is not contemporary with Jesus at all. This is generations removed.
In my experience in being, because I was big into apologetics for a long time when I was in the church and going to Bible college and everything, and I read Josh McDowell, Evidence That Demands a Verdict, and I used to have all these arguments about the historicity of the gospel and the resurrection and everything else, and I was very much in that camp. And so you think, okay, it seems like there's this overwhelming evidence, extra-biblical evidence, that's presented by apologists of the gospels to say, no, that there's all kinds of historical evidence outside the Bible that proves that Jesus existed, that he died, he rose again, and all the rest of it. But what I hear you saying is actually the people who could have and should have been writing, the contemporary historians, don't say anything that actually did,
absolutely,
live during the time of Jesus in that first century.
Absolutely.
So what?
Yeah, it gets ridiculous how inflated that claim that there's all this other extra-biblical witness for Jesus. Because for the first part, I hunted down, from when I wrote Nailed, I hunted down as many of those as I could find, including Christian sources, including things that weren't contemporary at all. And I came up with maybe 17. And of all those, absolutely zero were contemporary. Josephus, the forged Josephus, is the closest thing that even comes to a contemporary in the first century. All the other things on the eyewitness list are people from the 2nd century, 3rd century, 4th century, even as far as the, 7th and 8th century. It was ridiculous to be citing some of these. And what's super ironic is some some of the ones they were quoting, several of them were talking about Christians, not Jesus full stop. But some of them that were talking about Christians was Satyrus Lucius, Lucian, who spends his time talking about what suckers Christians are and how easily fooled they were, how gullible they were, and how his friend Peregrine wrote fake scriptures that were Christian scriptures. The ironic thing about these so-called witnesses that Christians pull out as proof of Jesus is, A, for the most part, none of them are talking about Jesus. They're talking about Christians. And it's like, no one doubts there were Christians alive in the second century, in the third century. But the really ironic thing is some of their so-called eyewitnesses are talking about what gullible suckers Christians are and how they'll fall for anything and how this one con artist wrote many of their Christian scriptures. So they're not even reading what things that are they think are proof are nothing of the sort, and they all point to the opposite.
Exactly the opposite. They're being mocked for their gullibility rather than being praised for their faith or whatever. We can definitely say there was a religion called Christianity that came into existence, what, sometime around end of the first century, end of the or early second century? There's no doubt that there is a religion called Christianity.
I'm gonna stop you. Let me stop you there, because I think it starts even earlier than that.
Right.
I think there were many religions called Christianities eventually, but these Christian movements started at closer to the beginning of the first century, if not sometime in the first century BC or BCE, if you will.
How different were those religions? Because this is something we were talking about the other day, that there are other gospels out there that for one reason or another did not become part of the Christian canon accepted Bible. So what does that show?
We have a handful of those. But we also have in our own scripture, we have people like Paul complaining that there are pastors out there who preach another Jesus, another Christ, another gospel. And he condemns them as being agents of Satan. That's how different they are from each other.
So what does that actually show? Because you could look at it a couple of ways, couldn't you? You could say on the one hand, Paul's upholding the true gospel. He's being dogged all the time, everywhere he goes, by these what he calls Judaizers, that want to have people observe the Old Testament laws and accept Christ and all this. But then you could say, well,
here's the thing about that, Clint, is that we say that he was saying that about Judaizers.
Yeah, that's
he may not have even been talking about Judaizers. He may have been talking about people who had nothing in common with even the Jewish version of Christ. I mean, Christianity definitely seems to have started as a Jewish version of the mystery faith. But everywhere that we look, the further we go back, the more we see that there was a civil war between, you know, the Jewish-leaning Christians and the Gentile Christians, and that there were so many forms that we don't know what exactly they were teaching. But when you look at what Paul seems to have been teaching, and like the author of the book of Hebrews seems to have teaching, they seem to have been teaching a celestial Messiah, one that they never even imagined was ever on earth at all.
The classic Christian response is that Paul had it right, of course, and the true gospel that he claimed to uphold was, in fact, the Orthodox Christian faith. But, of course, yeah, you could say, well, let's look at it from a completely different point of view and say Paul's gospel kind of won out in a way. The other ones were suppressed or they were just ignored or wiped out by the Catholic Church. One of my favorite things to study is the Cathars in southern France.
Oh, yeah.
And that was, that was, you know, we're talking 11th, 12th, 13th century, a lot longer than what Paul was around. But they were brutally suppressed and wiped out by the Catholic Church.
Absolutely. The whole Albigensian Crusade was nothing about getting rid of the Cathars. That was all that it was about.
A different gospel, if you will, to put it in Paul's terms. We can't have that. We're going to wipe them out. And they did. They ruthlessly wiped out all the Cathars and made it. And then that's what spurred the medieval Inquisition and then later the Spanish Inquisition that comes out of that type of movement, doesn't it? You've got this brutal suppression of any different strands of Christianity or Judaism or even Islam in southern Spain. And so this is the Catholic Church's legacy. And it goes on into the Reformation and everything else. It's kind of ironic, isn't it, that probably the only time during the Reformation period that the Catholics, the Lutherans, and the Calvinists, the Reformed Church, could agree on anything was they agreed that the Anabaptists were heretical, and all three teamed up to try to wipe them off the face of the earth as a heretical sect because they dared to baptize believing adults. Yeah. That wasn't that long ago, 500, 600 years ago.
What a jungle it is. It's a Darwinian jungle out there. You don't even have to go that far in time. Back to the 3rd century when the Nag Hammadi Gospels were written. If that little library of hidden scrolls hadn't been discovered in the 20th century, we would have no idea just how diverse Christianity was. And as it is, we still only have an inkling of an idea. But these books that came out of that time are so different from what we would think of as Christianity. We can barely identify that as Christianity. Here's another strange thing about our surviving text. Bart Ehrman has done an amazing job of just showing how at every single level, every textual level of surviving scripture, surviving New Testament scriptural text, we even have letters from the early Christian authors complaining about their rivals changing scripture or changing scripture back in some cases. And to such an extent that Bart Ehrman points out that one of the remarkable things about early Christian literature is the extent to which it was forged. And our New Testament shows that in spades. Every single book in the New Testament, except for the 6 more or less genuine books of Paul, are forgeries. They are not written by the people that it claims to be. Almost certainly not.
Funny thing about your comment about the church fathers, as you say, when you read a lot of the church fathers, what you find are letters, and a lot of them are titled against so-and-so, against yes. the teachings of the Sabellians, against the false teachings yep. of the Pelagians, or whatever heresy they yep. want to, and it's bishops in different cities and church fathers that are writing to express their point of view and say, no, the Pelagians have it wrong, the Sabellians have it wrong, so-and-so has it wrong, we've got the true Orthodox gospel. And I find a lot of the doctrines of Christianity come out of those historical contexts. They're the ones who survived in a way, whereas the other ones, people like Arius, for example, he was exiled and died in a public toilet. And that was the end of Arius.
Poison.
Yeah, so they say.
He was poisoned, yeah.
His guts fell out in a public toilet, so it's a horrible way to go.
Exactly. Or the wrath of God, depending on who you're asking.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, of course, you've got to tie in the whole politics and religion piece of this, too, don't you? Because around that time of Arius, you've got the Constantine making Christianity the official religion of the state of Rome, so he can't right. have divergent Christian messages going on, can he? You couldn't afford it, really.
Exactly.
So he had to,
exactly.
he had to have one kind of Orthodox faith, if you will. A lot of people point to that yep. kind of time and say, well, that's when the rot kind of set in a way, between the church climbing in bed with the state.
Yeah, and there's an irony there, too, like there is almost every time you look at anything to do with early Christianity. But our earliest complete New Testaments come from that same period, the early 4th century. We have 2 of them, the Codex Sinaiticus and the Codex Vaticanus, and neither of them quite agrees with each other. And neither of them quite agrees with us. We have books they don't have. They have books we don't have. That's funny. That's ironic, for starters.
Well, what do you think? Did David convince you that Jesus never existed at all? Or did it make you really upset and angry? And I could totally understand why you'd be upset. If, for example, you're a Christian, then, of course, your whole faith rests upon not just the veracity of the Gospels themselves in terms of their historicity, but, of course, what they affirm about Jesus, who he was, what he did. So what, of course, that means is that if a mythicist like David Fitzgerald is correct, then there's a lot of real serious issues that you're going to have to look at. But, you know, this is not the first time that this issue has been brought up. As we mentioned before, this has been going on for more than 100 years, actually even as far back as the 18th century. In fact, we can even take a look at an example of something that goes back well over 100 years ago on this very subject of the historicity of Jesus. I want to read a little quote from Albert Schweitzer's book, The Quest of the Historical Jesus. Now, this came out in 1906, and what he said was, quote, "The Jesus of Nazareth, who came forward publicly as the Messiah, who preached the ethic of the kingdom of God, who founded the kingdom of heaven upon earth, and died to give his work its final consecration, never existed." He goes on to say, "He is a figure designed by rationalism, endowed with life by liberalism, and clothed by modern theology in a historical garb. This image has not been destroyed from outside," says Schweitzer. "It has fallen to pieces," end quote. So really, if you think about it, what David Fitzgerald and other mythicists are saying, this is just another iteration in a debate that's been going on as far back as the 18th through the 19th century, and now in our modern time, this is still a relevant issue. And it's something that we all need to take a serious look at, especially if you've come out of Christianity or you're still involved and you identify yourself as a Christian. This is a huge topic that you need to do your own research and come up with some conclusions. I just want to provide you some alternative points of view so that you can be challenged and you can learn to think critically, which is, of course, one of the major aims of this entire podcast, why I'm doing what I'm doing. Now, next week, David and I are going to finish our conversation. We're going to be getting more into the historical record. We're also going to be looking at this issue of Christians and politics. And even though we're hearing a lot today about the Christian or evangelical support for politicians like Donald Trump, both during his campaign and also now as president, it actually goes back to the time of Constantine. And this is nothing new, where the church has climbed into bed with the state in order to preserve its own power and preserve the status quo and its religious liberties, all in the name of suppressing any heretical sect or any sect that it deems to be unorthodox or against the way they read the Bible. So this is really nothing new. So please come back and check out next week's conversation with myself and David Fitzgerald. I want to hear from you. As I've said before, you can find my links on social media here in the show notes. You can follow me on Twitter at MindShift2018, and you can send me an email, and all those links, as I say, are in the show notes. So let me know what you think of this conversation. Once again, I have been your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. Thank you for joining myself and David Fitzgerald for this episode of Mindshift Podcast, and I will see you next Friday. Yesterday.